This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. First Financial Tax and Accounting Services provides signature support for our program. Your number is 877-217-5757. You can send us an email to talk@talklouisiana.org. We start by popular demand with Dr. Ina Park, Associate Professor at the University of California, San Francisco School of Medicine. Dr. Park is a medical consultant at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the Division of STD Prevention, and the Medical Director of the California Prevention Training Center. Her book, Strange Bedfellows, Adventures in the Science, History, and Surprising Secrets of STDs, has gained a life of its own. And we had many people ask for a return visit, and here she is. Good morning, Dr. Park.
Good morning, Jim. I'm so happy to be with you.
It's good to hear your voice again.
Yes.
This is serious business, and in Louisiana, we have a significant problem. Let's start with a big one, and we'll move to the others, but
sure.
HIV, Baton Rouge, number one in the nation, Miami, mm-hmm. two, New Orleans, number three. We have a higher mm-hmm. incidence than other cities in the country, and it's a cause for concern. And despite all the knowledge we have about AIDS and HIV and how it is transmitted, nonetheless, people still take chances.
Mm-hmm. It's true. I mean, you know, the thing that's so tricky is that people who actually know their HIV status, Jim, are not the ones actually spreading the infection, because people who know their status and who are taking medication actually are able to suppress their virus to undetectable levels so they can't transmit it sexually. So it's this concept that we talk about called U equals U, which means if you're undetectable, you're untransmittable. The issue is that due to, you know, people's fear or lack of access to testing, they don't know their status. And so the people who are actually spreading HIV are the ones who are just walking around thinking nothing is wrong. And so I think if we, you know, really increase access to testing, including, you know, allowing people to test at home privately and increasing, you know, access to free testing, I really think that would help, you know, inform people of their status and then be able to get them onto medication and suppress their virus so we could reduce the incidence of HIV over here in the South.
Baton Rouge, according to the CDC, has 44.7 of every 100,000 people mm-hmm. infected with HIV. Now, that number is high, and it's the highest in America per capita, but it's not as high as it once was, and now we live in a world where people can live a long time with HIV and AIDS. And as a result of that, you've been featured on All Things Considered and in other places. Mm-hmm. People are taking more chances and getting other kinds of mm-hmm. STDs. How prevalent is that?
Yeah, you know, absolutely people are, Jim, because one of the things that folks are doing, and I'm very happy about this, by the way, that this exists, is taking something called HIV PrEP or pre-exposure prophylaxis. So you can actually take some of these HIV medications for people who are HIV negative, take it daily like a birth control pill, and it prevents HIV. But when that happens, sometimes condoms go off the table because HIV PrEP is on board, and so fear of HIV is gone. So what has happened, Jim, is there's been an enormous upsurge of STDs. And in fact, the last time we talked, the CDC had not released their data, and it's delayed because of, you know, because of the pandemic. But prior to the pandemic, we had the highest numbers of STIs ever reported to the CDC in 2019.
The highest ever?
Ever. Yes.
Wow. And that is a concern because these maladies often are lifelong as well.
You know, some of them can be. Some things like HPV-related cancer can last, you know, and obviously you need to get treated. Sometimes they can be fatal, but luckily if you, you know, for things like HPV-related cancer, there's a vaccine as well as there's really effective screening for cervical cancer for women. So it doesn't need to be, you know, a lifelong or fatal condition, but it certainly can be. And things like chlamydia and gonorrhea can cause infertility, which, you know, obviously is permanent. So yes, I mean, it's something that we want to take seriously. We don't want to stop having sex. I want people to go out and enjoy their sex lives, but getting tested is so crucial because many of these infections have no symptoms, Jim.
877-217-5757 for Dr. Ina Park, who is associate professor at the University of California, San Francisco, and a medical consultant for the Centers for Disease Control Prevention. Now, her book, Strange Bedfellows, as mentioned, has been an overwhelming presence in this world and is now considered by some the definitive word on the latest we know about STDs. And you in the book write about what you call the omnipresence of the human papilloma virus. What do you mean?
So what I want to let listeners know, Jim, is that HPV or human papillomavirus is pretty much a universal consequence of being a sexually active person. So I have gotten so, you know, since the book came out, I've gotten so many emails and messages on social media from folks who are feeling terrible about the fact that they were infected with HPV. And the truth is that every person gets exposed to HPV. There are over 200 types, and about 40 types can infect the genital area. And it's, you know, really, it's just like getting the common cold. So I don't want people to feel, you know, ashamed or stigmatized by it, because it's just, you know, basically over 80% of sexually active people are going to get it. So it's just something that we need to accept. And for the folks who are under 45, they can go ahead and get vaccinated to prevent, you know, the most common type that cause cancer. And then, as I mentioned before, for, you know, for women, they can get cervical cancer screening to make sure that they don't have any, you know, HPV infections that are developing pre-cancer or cancer. So there's a lot we can do, Jim, to prevent it. And, you know, from a vaccination standpoint, but also just accept that everyone is going to be exposed.
Now, you say that some people, they know they have it when they get genital warts, but most people don't.
Yeah.
So how do people generally find out?
Yeah, you know, you often don't. That's why we're sort of going around unawares, spreading HPV all over the place. And so most people don't know that they have it. And it is the rare person who actually ends up with a abnormal pap test, you know, or showing cervical precancer, or ends up with genital warts. It's probably, you know, less than 10% of the folks who actually get HPV will actually show any signs. So again, it's one of those things that I say, don't try to avoid it. You know, condoms help, but they certainly don't protect against everything, because HPV can go all over the skin surfaces that condoms can't cover. So again, Jim, it's one of those things we need to learn how to live with, you know, test for what we can test for, and please vaccinate. In some ways, it's, you know, sort of similar to how we've had to learn how to live with COVID.
And how is it treated once somebody has it?
Well, for genital warts, you know, there's, you know, freezing techniques, and there's also lots of creams and solutions that can be applied. And then for cervical precancer, you know, there are minor surgeries that can be performed. And again, you know, this does not necessarily mean that somebody who has it is going to have any issues with their fertility or their sex life after the fact. Most of the time, folks are able to, you know, treat these infections and precancers before they develop into cancer. Unfortunately, we still do have, you know, cervical cancer in this country, but it's much, you know, lower prevalence than it used to be.
Now, will HPV go away on its own, or does it need some kind of antibiotic, something to thwart the continuation?
No, believe it or not, Jim, most people don't have to do anything, and it'll go away on its own, usually within 2 years. So, you know, in really interesting studies of folks, when they first enter their college years, these are women, they test them all as freshmen. And by the end of college, you know, almost, you know, 70 to 80% of them actually get HPV in those first 4 years of college. And then if you follow folks, you know, after they have HPV and test them sequentially, then by 2 years, almost everybody has cleared it, you know, 90% or so have gotten rid of the HPV on their own without doing anything or any intervention.
What kind of antibiotics are generally used when somebody is diagnosed with HPV?
So nothing, actually. No antibiotics are needed. Really, the only time you do any sort of treatment is if you end up with warts or some sort of precancer or abnormality on the pap smear. So, you know, if you just have an HPV infection, there's no, you know, antibiotics or treatment administered.
And it's a sensitive topic. If you'd like to call, don't be fearful. Dr. Park is a person who has written about STDs about as eloquently and as humorously as possible. And sometimes it's good to smile when we're talking about these things.
For sure.
877-217-5757. Now, you address the big S, syphilis. That's still around, and you say 2019 was a particularly bad year.
Yeah, it sure was. And, you know, just to give listeners some historical perspective, we almost eliminated syphilis in the year 2000. And 80% of the counties in the United States had no cases that year. And then, unfortunately, due to the rise of, you know, internet dating and hooking up, as well as the fact that people with HIV were living longer and we were less afraid of HIV, people started having unprotected sex again. And we're back now, you know, in 2019 with...
We're going to take a break, but we'll continue. Sure. We'll continue with the discussion with Dr. Ina Park. Her book is Strange Bedfellows, Adventures in the Science, History, and Surprising Secrets of STDs. Again, 877-217-5757 and talk at talklouisiana.org. Back in 90 seconds with Dr. Ina Park. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for being with us for Talk Louisiana. Matt Doyle is producing. 877-217-5757. We're discussing the sensitive topic of STDs and HIV. Unfortunately, Baton Rouge is number one in the nation in the rate per capita of HIV. Miami is two. New Orleans is three. The number one city for STDs, according to the CDC, is Jackson, Mississippi. New Orleans, number 11. And Baton Rouge is 16th. So we've got some issues, and Dr. Park is here to address any concerns that we may have, and it is a world in which it is uncertain, always has been, and if we engage in sexual relations, chances are, according to Dr. Park, at some point in our life we will have an STD and might not even know it. And the good news about HPV is it largely goes away. And sometimes it doesn't. Dr. Park addressed what happens at that point. And now we're talking about syphilis, which was around a long time. And then in 2000, you say, Dr. Park, it was thought to have been all but eradicated, and now it's back.
Exactly. And it's certainly come back with a vengeance. And it's not anything like the scale of what we have with chlamydia. You know, it's only 130,000 infections compared to 2.8 million for chlamydia, but still... Jim, after almost eradicating it, it's, you know, disappointing that it's back. And the issue that affects Louisianans as well as Californians, where I sit, is when it affects a pregnancy and can actually be spread from mother to child. And right now we have over 1,800 cases of congenital infections. Both Louisiana and California are right up there in the top states. And as we know, it can lead to very serious outcomes, such as stillbirths and neonatal deaths in the first 30 days of life. So for folks who are pregnant, getting screened during your pregnancy, you know, at least twice and sometimes three times in the first trimester, the third trimester, and sometimes at delivery is so key to detecting it and trying to get the baby treated early.
Minority communities, a listener asks, have been hit particularly hard by STDs per capita, much higher rate in minority communities. Is there an explanation why?
Yes, there definitely is. So, Jim, one of the things that people, you know, wonder when they hear that there are higher STD and HIV rates in minority communities, they wonder, oh, you know, is people's sexual behavior, you know, radically different? Do people have more partners? Are they less likely to use condoms? Well, that's actually not the case. When we look at, you know, heterosexual folks in minority communities, mm-hmm. in some communities, there are men who have been removed from the community due to violence or incarceration. And as you know, we have a huge incarceration issue in this country as well, Jim. And then we literally don't have enough men to go around for women. And so sometimes what we have is we have men who are having multiple partners because of these distorted ratios of men to women in certain counties. So if we have men having multiple partners, that's the way that STIs are spread, you know, very rapidly to women. So even if a woman only has one partner, if her partner has multiple partners, that is a sure way for her to be exposed to STDs and HIV. So it really has to do with forces that are so much larger than, you know, just the number of people you sleep with, Jim. It really has a lot to do with, you know, how many people are around, and as well as the fact that if folks in minority communities also just like to sleep with other folks of that minority community, the pool of people to sleep with is much smaller as well. So if there is an infection there, it's easier to spread in a smaller, you know, in a smaller network than in a larger network of people.
A listener asks about vaccinations, which you have discussed. What are the percentages of people who are getting them?
So the data that we have, Jim, are from the 13 to 17-year-olds. We have about half of the 13 to 17-year-olds in this country who are completely up to date on their vaccination for HPV, and about 70% have gotten one dose. So we certainly could do better. And, you know, the more vaccinations that we give, the less likely we are to see things like cervical cancer as well as warts. And in fact, in Australia, where they have 80% vaccination rates for adolescents, they've basically had a disappearance of genital warts. And in some countries, in the Scandinavian countries, they've seen a decline in cancer already. So we can get there, Jim. We just need to really get people vaccinated.
Dr. Ina Park, that's the voice we're hearing. Strange Bedfellows is her book. And as far as another listener asks about gender breakdown, men or women, who is more likely to be exposed and to contract some kind of an STD?
So I'm going to break it down. And for men who have sex with men, they seem to bear the greatest burden of STDs. And again, we talked about the fact that there are many less men who have sex with men than men who have sex with women. So the community is smaller. And if folks are having concurrent partners, then that certainly will lead to greater STDs. But it's women, unfortunately, Jim, who tend to suffer the longer-term consequences of STDs. So the things like cervical cancer and infertility and things like ectopic pregnancies, you know, those are the complications, obviously, that women are more likely to suffer. And men don't really have, you know, a correlate to that. Of course, there are men can get HPV-related cancer, and in fact, you know, head and neck cancer is more common in men related to HPV, as well as anal cancer, as well in gay men. But at any rate, both can suffer consequences, but unfortunately, women bear the brunt of more of the permanent consequences of STDs.
Are we having more sex now? Is that the reason we're at an all-time high, or is it just the case that we're not taking precautions as we should?
So, Jim, I don't, you know, I actually heard prior to the pandemic that sexual activity was on the decline among Americans. There was a large national study that looked at that. And so I personally think that it's just that people have gotten tired of using condoms and that we don't have anything better or new. You know, condoms have been around since the 1920s and haven't changed all that much. So I personally think that people are using less condoms than they used to. And we do know, though, that, Jim, I think people did actually slow down their sex lives during the pandemic, but my prediction is in the summer we're going to bounce right back and then some.
So we're not using condoms. That's probably what you write in the book, When the Rubber Meets the Road.
Yes, exactly. I mean, and I would love to see greater investment in, you know, additional prevention devices. And there are these, you know, new devices called multi-purpose prevention technologies. So things like a vaginal ring, for example, that would provide medication both against STIs, HIV, and provide contraception. So I think we need to, you know, think outside the box or think outside the, you know, the condom wrapper and think about new prevention methods that people will actually be excited about using.
And another listener asks about gonorrhea. Another oldie but goldie, but a serious, situation.
Yeah, the thing about gonorrhea that's so interesting, Jim, is it's a very clever, you know, bacteria. It develops antibiotic resistance really to everything we've thrown at it. And in December of 2020, we had two antibiotics that we were using to treat gonorrhea. We had to get rid of one of them. So we are down to one antibiotic in this country left to treat gonorrhea. If we lose the ability to use that antibiotic, we don't actually have anything ready to go off the shelf to treat gonorrhea. So this is a time I'm happy that people are getting vaccinated and getting out there and having sex, you know, with new partners again. But this is really a time until you know someone's status to use barriers because you don't want one of these antibiotic resistant infections.
You see patients all the time. What's the biggest revelation over the last few years with all the people you see, Dr. Park?
You know, I am still struck, Jim, by how ashamed folks feel and how they blame themselves when they get an STD. And so that's why I'm out there really pounding the drum, banging the drum here to normalize these infections and to hopefully help people feel empowered. I've been, you know, really struck by how bad people can feel and how much regret that they can feel. And so that's why I'm here to tell you that, you know, I've seen a lot of patients. Really, this is happening to people from all walks of life, you know, regardless of your race, ethnicity, sexual orientation. So, you know, please go get tested and take charge of your sexual health.
Well, it's always a pleasure to catch up with Dr. Ina Park. Strange Bedfellows is her book, Adventures in the Science, History, and Surprising Secrets of STDs. Dr. Park, thanks for joining us. Know you're busy. Keep up your good work, and we look forward to talking with you again.
Jim, I would love that. Thanks so much.
Our pleasure. And coming next, federal public defender Mark Upton with a major case with a remarkable development. We'll talk with him. Again, your Talk Louisiana number is 877-217-5757. Back in 3 minutes. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. 877-217-5757 is your number, and we're joined by federal public defender Mark Upton. Good morning, Mark.
Good morning, Jim.
Nice to talk with you, as always. It's been a little while since we've had the pleasure of exchanging views on the air, but Mark is involved in a case that was featured above the fold in the Metro section last Thursday. BR pays $35,000 settlement over search. Judge ripped officer for entering home with no warrant. The judge is Judge Brian Jackson, the Chief District Federal Judge. What happened?
Well, this happened January 1st, 2020. And Mr. Green, Clarence Green, and his brother were in a vehicle that was stopped by a police officer, Baton Rouge City police officer, for suspicious driving. And as the officer proceeded with his investigation, he located a gun on Mr. Clarence Green and some marijuana on his juvenile brother and arrested him for the gun. And then that was the first contact between Mr. Green and the police. And then because of the start of the COVID issue, juveniles were not being arrested and kept in the detention center. They were being turned over to their parents. So the police officer went to the Green's mother's apartment to turn over the have her accept custody of the brother, and nobody came to the door, and eventually he just opened the door, drew his weapon, and went inside and encountered the mother and a 10-year-old inside and searched the apartment, found another gun, and the charges were filed by the feds and U.S. Attorney's Office in this district, and the case came to us. And as we started looking at the evidence that they give us in discovery, it appeared to us that there were some problems with both the initial contact and stopping of the vehicle and later on the search of the apartment. So we filed a motion to suppress, to have a hearing on those issues to see whether constitutional rights were violated. And after the end of the hearing, the judge issued an order several days later that was pretty pretty serious in its allegations against in what it found as a result of the evidence that he saw and the evidence that we brought out at that hearing. The result was that the motion to suppress was granted. All the evidence that was seized was suppressed, and Mr. Green was ordered released immediately.
Well, the Baton Rouge Metro Council voted to pay the defendant $35,000 in taxpayer money. This is a acknowledgement of bad policing. What's happened to the officer?
The only thing I know about Officer Kamala is that there are proceedings happening in the police department. That is not anything I've followed. Our office had nothing to do with the $35,000 settlement that Mr. Green received. That whole thing was done by a law professor, Professor Frampton, from the University of Virginia Law School. And my understanding is that he pro bono undertakes to represent people whose rights have been violated across the country, similar to Mr. Clarence Green's, and that he has had some success with that.
Your number, if you'd like to join our conversation with Mark Upton, federal public defender, is 877-217-5757. The story from Malia Skeen says rather than let the drop charges fade into the background, Chief District Judge Brian Jackson issued an order lambasting the arrest and the prosecution as emblematic, this is a quote from the judge, emblematic of precisely the type of foul blows universally condemned by our jurisprudence. Now, is this an outlier, or does this kind of thing happen more frequently than we would like to think?
Well, there's two aspects to that. Violations of citizens' civil rights happens far too often. But an order, what you're reading from is the order of the judge. When the government, after the hearing, the judge ordered us to file simultaneous post-hearing memoranda arguing our points of view. And as we were preparing our memoranda, we got an order from a motion from the government dismissing the indictment. And when you do that, when you file a request for relief with the government in federal court, you prepare the order that you want the judge to sign. And so the United States did that, and the order they prepared and submitted to the judge for his signatures was just a little three-line order saying, considering the government's motion to dismiss, it is ordered that leave is granted, the indictment in criminal number 20-46 is dismissed with prejudice. And that would ordinarily, the judge would sign that, and that would be the end of it. But in this case, Judge Jackson was so disturbed by the evidence in the hearing that he added a rather lengthy footnote to the motion to dismiss, in which he took the police to task for what had occurred. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting because there are people like Professor Frampton who read these orders from all over the United States as they're published, and it generated quite a lot of activity. I got contacted by people all over the United States asking, in essence.
All right. I think we just lost Mark for a moment. Let's see if we can get him back, Matt. But Thomas Frampton, the attorney that Mark quoted, says of the body camera video, it's both banal and horrifying, showing a form of ritualized humiliation and contempt for civil rights. These aren't bad apples. These are some of the best officers on the force. So it's a case in which obviously, most people would not want their home invaded and by anybody, but especially by a police officer, and an unusual rebuke from the federal bench by Judge Brian Jackson, who says that police showed serious and wanton disregard, first by initiating a traffic stop on the thinnest pretext, and then by haphazardly invading the defendant's home to conduct an unjustified warrantless search. And the search was so bad that Judge Jackson wrote the officers could potentially be charged with criminal trespassing. 877-217-5757 is your number. And I think we've got Mark back. And let's go to Henry at the Country Club of Louisiana, who's been waiting. And we'll get Mark to chime in. Henry, you are on the air. Welcome to Back to Talk Louisiana. Hi, Henry.
Well, good morning, Mr. Jim. Good morning, Mr. Mark. Y'all a couple fine fellas. Hope you had a great holiday. One thing that concerns me, obviously, we saw the civil rights violations happen on the body cams, but prior to the search of the house, I was kind of concerned about a 16-year-old kid being strip searched by the Baton Rouge City Police in broad daylight out there. That almost seems like that'd be some crime, not molesting, but along in those lines. What do you think about that, Mr. Mark?
You know,
well, it's interesting, Henry. What that seemed to be, this story was picked up by Nora O'Donnell in CBS News last week and run on the national, on their national news program. And that was the issue that CBS News nationally thought was the most disturbing. And it certainly is disturbing, although from the standpoint of the relief that we were trying to get for Mr. Green, and only the older brother was our client, the relief that we were trying to get, that search, that part of the search, the, that aspect of it being strip searched on the street is not legally significant, although I think it did play some part in the amount of the award that he received for the experience that he went through.
As we know, we're having a record year with homicides, and police officers are understaffed and underpaid and overstressed. Some would say that some stuff like this is a byproduct of that, Mark.
You know, I think there's some, there may be something to that, but there were, there have been other cases involving this officer and judges in this district where his searches have been thrown out. So I don't think you can lay it all on the COVID, at least as far as this particular incident goes.
Are you receiving more complaints of this kind?
Well, we every case we get, one of the first evaluations we do is evaluate the case to see whether or not there are any problems with the arrest, with the search, with the investigation, with any warrants that were issued, and that's a standard thing that we do. And I'll be honest, the, by and large, most of the police, they are well-educated in what the constitutional requirements are, and they do a very good job of making sure that nobody's cutting any corners and that, that all the constitutional rights that a suspect or a defendant have are observed.
We'll spend a bit more time with Mark Upton when we return after this quick timeout on Talk Louisiana. Your number 877-217-5757. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for being with us for Talk Louisiana. Matt Doyle producing. A few more minutes with Mark Upton, federal public defender, longtime attorney in East Baton Rouge Parish, graduate of the Paul M. Abara Law Center. And he is, of course, here today to talk about this settlement that was paid, $35,000, when an officer entered a home with no warrant. Judge Brian Jackson rebuked the officer, Ken Camallo, who is on regular duty. And it was a case involving a young man who got caught with a gun that he should not have had. But, Mark, sometimes judgment calls are made. Sometimes they're good. Sometimes they're not. Police officers are not immune to making mistakes. Was this just an honest mistake?
Well, I have to say that there were some problems with the way this whole contact with Mr. Green and the people who were in the vehicle that he was a passenger in occurred. And, I mean, when the initial report says that the basic reason for the stop was for suspicious driving in a high crime area, well, that any defense lawyer with this salt, their ears are going to prick up when they hear that, because I don't know that suspicious driving is a crime.
Phil in Jefferson Terrace. Phil, you're on with Mark. Good morning.
Yes, good morning. If I understand, it becomes a life and death situation for a traffic stop. Now, I know we have the right to remain silent. What do you advise people to do if you do remain silent and then still not get shot by a cop. I mean, golly.
Mark?
Well, it's hard to give general advice across the board when circumstances are so different on an individual case-by-case basis. If you've been drinking and you get stopped, my advice is shut up. Don't walk, don't talk, don't look at the light, don't repeat the alphabet, and ask for your lawyer. If you're driving down the street and a police officer said you did something wrong and you want to know what you did, well, I don't think that there's any problem with engaging with the police officer at that time. But different circumstances give rise to different responses from the public.
What if you get stopped for suspected drunken driving and you haven't been drinking? Or maybe you only had a pop or two and know you're in full command of your faculties. What do you do then?
My advice is if there's any alcohol on your breath, everything that officer is going to do from that point forward is going to be towards proving that you are, in fact, under the influence. And so the best thing to do is to not talk to him, ask for your lawyer, and shut up.
All right. Dan downtown. Dan, you're on with Mark. Good morning.
Morning. Has the politicalization of the federal judiciary, especially under Trump, been a cause for concern of the federal defense bar?
I can't speak for other districts. I can tell you that the judges we have in this district are some of the hardest working, smartest judges, and I practice across the southeastern United States. They're some of the hardest working, smartest judges I've ever encountered. And while certainly the appointment of judges is a political issue, I don't think that it's had a real effect on the status of justice in the Middle District of Louisiana.
What about funding for public defenders across the country? Is that still going on, or is there a dip that is alarming?
Well, the big difference is the public defenders in the federal system and the public defenders in the state system. We all know what a horrible situation it is with state public defenders and their just horrible caseloads and the lack of funding, which has been going on since I first started practicing criminal law 42 years ago. The federal system is not the same. If I've got a case that requires me to get a blood splatter expert and the best guy I can find is some guy in California, if I go through the paperwork and I can show that I need that expert and I may need $20,000 or $30,000 to get that expert to come and testify in a case I've got, I can get those services. And that's the main difference between the federal and the state system. Our caseloads are dramatically lower than they are in the state system. And so it's just a different process altogether, being a federal public defender versus a state public defender. And I admire all of the people who work in the state system as public defenders.
Well, thank you, Mark. Good to talk with you. And keep
you
going.
You too, Jim.
See you soon. We're joined in studio by Tyra Banks. She is here today as part of the All of Us Research Initiative. Tyra is an activist on a few fronts in our community, but tell us more about the All of Us Research Initiative.
Thanks so much for having me today. I always enjoy coming to see your show and listening to your show.
Thank you.
So the All of Us Research Initiative is a part of the Precision Medicine Act, and it's a 10-year study that wants to encompass a bunch of diversity so that 1 million Americans are enrolled to help share their health data, their microbiome, their genetic diversity with researchers so that we can find greater cures, understand why some people are healthy, why some people get sick, and how our differences contribute to that.
You're talking largely about minority people, correct?
Absolutely. So the goal of the study is to increase, one goal is to increase the outreach and the participation of ethnic and racial minorities, because we have not been a part of medical research by and large.
And Blue Cross is one of the people involved. I think you're partnering with them, correct?
Absolutely. Yeah. So Blue Cross is one of 100 organizations that have come to put this together. So back in, I want to say 2016, when President Obama signed the Precision Medicine Act,
right.
Part of the funding went toward the All of Us Research Initiative getting off the ground with NIH. And so almost 100 partners. We have Black Greek Letter organizations, which I'll talk a little bit about a webinar that we have coming up on June 9th. We have Cobb Research Institute, Southern University. I mean, just a number of partners, mm-hmm. and Blue Cross Blue Shield is one of them.
All of Us is a research program from the National Institutes of Health, seeking, as Tyra says, 1 million or more people from across the country. And by doing so, it hopes to one day help speed up medical research. And people who join will share information about their health, their habits, and what it's like where they live. And by looking for patterns, researchers may learn more about what affects people's health. So how does a person get involved with this?
Definitely check out joinallofus.org/LA to learn more about the joining process. And I encourage everyone to go and take a look at the National Institutes of Health YouTube mm-hmm. channel. Check out the All of Us Research Initiative videos. One of the things, my grandmother died of cancer. We lived two doors down from each other, wore the same size clothes, had pretty much the same diet. And we, about a month apart from each other, found out that we both had lumps in our necks. Mine was not cancer. Hers was. And what was so interesting to me was that precision medicine exists for cancer treatment. But there's not a lot of African-American women that are involved in cancer research. And so that means anything that's prescribed to us, oftentimes it's one-size-fits-all mm-hmm. medicine, right? And I don't know about you, but you and I are a lot alike, but we're very different in our genetic and physical makeup. And we know that that impacts what would work well for me versus what would work well for you. And so doctors and researchers have been a part of this initiative since the beginning to increase that diversity and make sure that we can offer better options to people. And so I tell people, check it mm-hmm. out. It's not one of those things where you're going to get experimented on. You're sharing your information so that researchers have the ability to fight disease, come up with better treatment plans, detect issues, mm-hmm. And look at the things that make us different, whether or not you're in a rural community versus in the city. All those things make a difference in our health.
And a listener notes that not only do we not know as much about minority health, but the professionals. There aren't as many minority doctors as there are people Absolutely. Of the majority race.
Absolutely. I love the work. If any of your listeners are interested, check out Cobb Institute, working to increase the number of minorities that are represented. We know that treatment and also the advancement of ethics and research, there's progress that happens when you have women and you have minorities at the mm-hmm. table.
Now, this webinar, June 9th, what's going to happen? That's a week from today, right?
Absolutely. Check out Blue Cross Blue Shield's Wellness Wednesdays on the Blue Cross Blue Shield LA page on Facebook. And you'll right. be able to register for the webinar. We'll have Mayor Adrian Perkins on there. We'll have representatives from different Black Greek Letter organizations. They're going to talk about health and closing the disparities in our community and how it's on all of us to get that done.
And not only is there a dearth of professionals who are minority and perhaps not as much minority research going on for people of color, but the life expectancy is lower as well.
Absolutely. And we know that there are some factors that contribute to that. Poverty, housing discrimination, I mean, all these things, availability of care, whether or not you have insurance, all those things impact your life expectancy, your ability to thrive, whether or not you live in a food desert. And so one of the things I love about, I'm a participant of All of Us, one of the things I love about it is the survey questions. We get to answer about our community, our health habits, the environment that we live in. All so right. hopefully researchers find the connections.
Website again for the All of Us Research Initiative?
joinallofus.org/LA.
joinallofus.org/LA. Thank you, Tyra Banks. Always
Thanks
good
for
to
having
see you.
Me.
First Financial Tax and Accounting Services provides signature support. Until tomorrow, for Matt Doyle, I'm Jim Inkster. Thank you for listening, and stay safe and stay tuned.